This is the second day of this July 2016 seven-day session. And we'll return to our text from yesterday, a book called The Original Face, which is an anthology, a collection of Japanese Zen masters in the Rinzai lineage. We just finished reading a section from the sayings of Zen Master Bunan of the 17th century, things people are always wrong about. And now we turn to Bunan's regulations for disciples. He starts off with a provocative statement. A monk is the greatest evil on earth. He goes through the world without labor. He is a great thief. It doesn't take a lot of imagination to understand that he is imploring his monks to earn their keep by coming to awakening. Probably it's always been the case. Certainly was in China, in ancient China, but probably in Japan too, and elsewhere, that there were monks who became ordained as a way to escape the world. Escape the draft, they say, was one reason, and other reasons that are less than the ideal. And here he's reminding the monks, look, you get all this, you get your 3 squares a day, well, 2 probably, 2 square meals a day, and housing and clothing, and what have you done to deserve that? In Japan, I think more even than in China, shame. It's a great motivator, the threat of bringing shame to one's community or family or community, one's ancestors. And Bunan here is prodding them in that way, only for the purpose of spurring them on to awakening. He is a great thief, this monk. He continues, when the fruits of discipline and practice are fulfilled, and one may be a teacher of others, he is a precious jewel in the world. There are innumerable teachers of the ways of the world, but teachers of the great way are rare. And suddenly what follows is a kind of a non sequitur. Do not use unwisely even a piece of paper or half a penny. This is a cardinal rule of Zen monasticism and Zen training more broadly, not to waste anything. And it's not primarily because of the cost economically, but to waste anything is to show disrespect and to betray a sense of to betray an understanding of the ultimate value, the ultimate worth of paper or food especially, or water. Someone who is seen into the indivisibility of all things would find it painful to waste anything until one feels that pain of wasting water or electricity or food or anything else, then we have these rules to prevent the trainee from sowing more bad karma, you could say. We've always been pretty strict about paper napkins, for example. Most paper napkins come in a size or a volume that is at least twice as much as you really need. And so over the years, we've often taken the time to cut these paper napkins in half rather than wasting them. I think now it seems we did find a size that is just right, that don't have to be cut in half. It's just respect. Respect for things. Respect for the self that we call napkins, the self that we call electricity, the self that we call water, the self that we call food, our own self, self-nature. Be constantly austere with the body and do not do things for the sake of the body. The enemy of Dharma and Buddha is the body. Well, this is more sort of basic Zen teaching, not to be ruled by the body and its cravings for comfort and other things. This is a big one for an awful lot of people. Maybe, certainly, it's a big one for Americans, modern contemporary Americans, more than it was in the Japan of Bunan's day, where there's such an expectation that we not have to put up with discomfort, whether it's in sitting, the posture, or the temperature, the heat, the cold. But always felt that we can only go against the grain of people so much. And for us Americans who are raised expecting to be comfortable in all situations, then we have to give a little bit. And so we have these myriad cushions of 3, 4, 5 different kinds of cushions in abundance in the cushion storage room that people can use to relieve some of the pain, discomfort of sitting. And all right, take away that as an excuse for holding back in practice. But then even we as contemporary Americans can go too far with this and expect more than is naturally right. By that I mean that to have a body means discomfort or pain. That's our lot. Anything, humans, animals, anything corporeal has to face physical pain sooner or later. And let's face it in the proportions where we can manage it and learn to manage pain so that when we can't solve it, resolve the pain, physical pain, with extra cushions, we'll be ready. We'll have the resources, the spiritual resources to deal with pain when we're afflicted with serious illness, injury, and ultimately when we're on our deathbed. Let's use this, play this edge of pain, where we recognize that some pain can concentrate the mind. It can use it. Too much pain becomes a distraction. So it's just a question of where each one of us finds that line. Aitken Roshi is a phrase I've often quoted where he says, you want to sit at the forward edge of your pain. Come on, a little bit. It sharpens the mind, helps with concentration. Surely we have the stamina and the concentration to work with a little pain. Without any pain at all, the mind can go slack. As anyone knows who's had to do zazen lying on their back, there have been every once in a while someone has a serious enough back problem that they go through sesshins lying down. What a challenge that is to keep the mind concentrated. He continues, look upon accepting things from others as like poison. Be a great advice for politicians who continually get themselves in trouble with accepting gifts from those who have an interest in legislation that the politician has a hand in. Look upon accepting things from others as like poison. When you have completely realized the great way, then you should accept those things which people hold dear. This is because it helps those people. It's very interesting, and probably a mostly a monastic viewpoint. Again, telling his monks, be vigilant about what you are taking from others. This would be especially important in a culture like these East Asian cultures, Buddhist cultures, in Japan and China and Korea, where the donor would often have his own self-interest in mind in giving to the monks. They want to acquire merit. So Bunan is warning us that whenever you receive something, you run the risk of overindulging yourself and playing into this misconception that someone will receive merit. But then, he says as an exception, when you've completely realized the great way, not just realized it, but completely realized, okay, then you should accept those things which people hold dear. This is because it helps those people. It's a practice of dana. You can't practice dana. These supporters of the monks can't practice dana unless the monks receive it. It's a package deal. So then he relents, Bunan says, and when you have great enlightenment, then yeah, take things from people which they offer that are important to them, because then This enables them to practice giving, generosity, which is a way of getting free of the self and its clinging nature. During the period of practice and effort, should you be beaten and trampled by others, you should rejoice that the effects of the deed you yourself produced in the past are being exhausted. So this is another way of dealing with mistreatment by others. That you can take it as an opportunity to expiate a painful karma that you yourself have sown in the past. This can work. It's a cognitive method of dealing with mistreatment. Is just framing it as, okay, I'm getting rid of some bad karma here by having suffered at the hands of this person. If nothing else, it helps. It helps avoid resentments that would otherwise occur. This word trampled, it's an odd choice of words, unless you think of Dokusan Rush and how that can get rambunctious. People can get rambunctious in the Dokusan Rush. How many people, if they got shoved during a Dokusan Rush, would be able to not react with anger? This isn't, I understand this is not much of a problem anymore with people getting rough during Dokusan Rushes, but just as an example of a way in which you could neutralize resentment if you were able to just see it as something that you yourself caused, you yourself set in motion. Maybe it was earlier in this lifetime, maybe it was some other distant past lifetime, but to receive it in that way could make all the difference. Just in helping your own practice. If you sit with resentment at being mistreated, then this is harmful to your practice. If you can let it go, then you benefit. He continues, when Master Joshu was asked if a dog has enlightened nature or not, he said, mu. If you can really understand this mu, you will surely be free from doubts about anything in or out of this world. For example, when you first enter, you shatter being and nothingness. Enter here means when you enter the first gate, to use a similar phrase, which is a direct translation of a first awakening experience. When you first enter, you shatter being and nothingness. That is, you see what is beyond both being and non-being. You see what is beyond both form and emptiness. Having shattered being and nothingness, if you nurture it energetically, you break through the body. Having broken through the body, if you work hard, you break through the mind. Having broken through body and mind, the original mind appears. When you reach that, then there is no doubt about what the world-honored Buddha taught. There are hells, there are heavens, there are enlightened ones and devils, hungry ghosts and animals. There is retribution. You will have no doubts at all about the sutras. I know this this Buddhist doctrine about the six realms of unenlightened existence is a bit much for people to swallow, some people in practice. What makes it easier to accept this ancient feature of Buddhist doctrine is if you just think of it as states of mind, hellish states of mind, heavenly states of mind, states of cravings, animal-like states of mind, and so forth. Then there is no doubt about what the world-honored Buddha taught. There is a koan in the Mumon Kan where the great Toksan, after his enlightenment, said, "I will no longer have doubts about any of the sayings of the monks of the world," or something like that. That is exactly what we are offered, the opportunity to confirm through our own experience, to confirm these teachings, and above all, the teaching of enlightenment. It's one thing to kind of believe these teachings, and enough that they seem plausible, yes, that we all have this enlightened nature. It's just a matter of opening our eyes and seeing it. That's one thing, to accept it provisionally enough to apply oneself to practice, but it's an entirely different thing, of course, to confirm it. He continues with a phrase in quotations here. "Originally not a single thing exists," he says, refers to the absolute non-existence of body and mind. The non-existence of body and mind. We all know about the existence of it, the way in which body exists. We stub our toe. Ouch! That's the existence nature of the body. What about the way in which it is non-existent? What about the emptiness of form? The no-thingness of things? Originally, not a single thing exists. This is the distinctive teaching and experience of the Dharma. It's not just that all things are one, all things are indivisible in their essential nature, but that they're non-existent. They're there, but not there. We are here, but not here. The one scroll that I keep in my quarters at the center is the same one that Roshi Kaplow had hanging in the same place. In calligraphy, reads, from the very beginning there has never been a single thing. How liberating to experience that, to confirm it. No self. What a relief. And now he continues with another section here. Bunan used to say to his group, "There is no special principle in the practice of the way. It's only necessary to see and hear directly." So, to follow up with what we were just saying, the principle of from the very beginning there's never been a single thing, you don't need to believe that. If you completely penetrate the practice you're working on, it's only necessary to see and hear directly. Directly seeing, there is no seeing. Directly hearing, there is no hearing. You must fuse inside and outside into one solid, thoroughly peaceful state before you can do this. Find out what this means. Seeing, there is no seeing. Hearing, there is no hearing. We grasp this teaching through complete fusion of self and breath, self and mu, self and whatever it is we're working on. That's what it takes. Not subscribing to any religion or signing up for any particular dogma, but just doing this, merging with one's practice. He continues, "Although you people are Buddhas right now, you don't realize it. If you know, you go against the Buddhas and patriarchs. If you don't know, you revolve in the routine of birth and death. At this point, if you don't have the transcendental eye, how can you attain realization?" What does he mean, "if you know, you go against the Buddhas and patriarchs"? Well, that if you're holding to the concept, I'm a Buddha, I'm enlightened in my true nature, then you're still clinging, still attached to an idea. If you don't know, here he changes it, if you haven't experienced this for yourself, you go on revolving in the wheel of birth and death. "Although our school considers enlightenment in particular to be fundamental, that doesn't necessarily mean that once you're enlightened, you stop there. It is necessary to practice according to reality and complete the way." So here he distinguishes between enlightenment and the way. The way is much bigger, broader. It includes the integration of the experience into one's daily living. That's a much, much bigger thing. He continues, "According to reality means knowing the fundamental mind as it really is. Practice means getting rid of obstructions caused by habitual actions by means of true insight and knowledge. Awakening to the way is comparatively easy. Accomplishment of practical application is what is considered most difficult. So that is proving one's insight in every kind of situation, in work and family life and everything. Showing, demonstrating one's awakening. This is far more difficult than the initial experience of it. That is why, he says, that is why the great teacher Bodhidharma said that those who know the way are many, whereas those who carry out the way are few. You simply must wield the jewel sword of the adamantine sovereignty of wisdom and kill the self. When this self is destroyed, you cannot fail to reach the realm of great liberation and great freedom naturally. Killing the self. Don't be concerned about that, the tone of that. This means seeing to the bottom that there has never been a separate self. It means unshackling yourself completely from the self, the notion of a self, a separate self. If you can really get to see your fundamental mind, you must treat it as though you were raising an infant. Walking, standing, sitting, lying down, illuminate everything everywhere with awareness, not letting him be dirtied by the seven consciousnesses. Well, basically, not allowing the mind to get snagged in attachment to the five senses and thought and self-consciousness broadly. If you can keep him clear and distinct, it is like the baby's gradually growing up until he's equal to his father. Calmness and wisdom, clear and penetrating, your function will be equal to that of the Buddhas and patriarchs. He's reminding us, as so many of the masters have, reminding us that there is this maturation process that can take years, decades after the initial awakening to be a fully grown Zen person, fully grown Buddha. Until we can really live out of our true nature. Now, the reason we consider human life best is because of the opportunity it holds to realize true liberation in this lifetime. However, if you seek profit and support, again, he's warning his monks, if you seek profit and support, considering these the ultimate truth, in every moment of thought used by delusive ideas, vainly ending your life, at the time of death, nothing you can do will be any use. The Buddha came into the world to guide those on the paths of illusion, directly pointed to the fundamental mind, letting them leave behind birth, death, and myriad things. This awakening is something accessible to everyone in this session, really everyone hearing this talk. There's no one who is who is not endowed with this nature. It's not that we have to become something we aren't. It's just seeing for ourselves that this is, that from the very beginning all beings are Buddha. Like water and ice, without water, no ice, outside us, no Buddhas. We can't just have this as a belief. We have to prove it through experience. See for ourselves that this is all true. If this very body is the body of Buddha. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.